Let's go to the phone lines right now and bring in our first guest today, and that's Albert Bates. He's a biologist. You're a lawyer and an educator and an author. I was glancing at something up on my sheet here. You might be a biologist. I don't know, Albert, but I doubt that you are. Are you?
Well, I'm a recovering attorney. But biology was one of the areas that I'm most interested in and am doing probably the most today.
And, of course, permaculturist. You're director of the Global Village Institute for Appropriate Technology. And I have to admit, I just like the idea of appropriate technology. How would you define that?
Well, you could use it in both senses of the word. It's appropriate in the sense that it's not too big, not too small, just right in the middle. But you could also say we're appropriating the technologies that are ethical and reasonable and inexpensive and accessible to most people from corporations, governments, and others who would tend to take them in the wrong directions.
You've been involved with so many things for so long. You're coming to Chicago for the 2nd of November and the Great Lakes Bioneer Chicago Conference. Last week we had Sandra Steingraber on. This week you and your keynote is the 2nd of November, Saturday morning, I believe at 9:30. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and of course at Roosevelt University. And your talk is going to be Cool, an eco-village eco-village responses to climate change. You know, before you got on the air today, I was talking a little bit about, and you and I actually had chatted a little bit ahead of time about Blake Davis from IIT, who you said you know, and he's been on this program, and he works with The Plant on the south side of Chicago. And he had the 50-year survival plan for climate change and talked about it on our show. And then, of course, the government shutdown happened in the last few weeks, and we came close to defaulting. And it occurred to me, this is all part of that plan, accidentally in some ways. But this is how it's a prime example of how our politics and our government is fraying at the seams and breaking down. So in your case, you want to be ready for that if it gets extreme, correct?
Yeah, I actually wrote a book about 2006. Called the Post-Petroleum Survival Guide, and it was also the survival guide and cookbook. So my idea was to provide recipes that could get people together around in neighborhoods to have talks about the things that needed to happen.
I think, yeah, and so you beat Blake Davis to the punch by about 7 years. It's interesting that your blog is what? It's called Peak Surfer, and I've got a link to it on my website, MikeNovak.net. You can go there. But I assume
the blog is called The Great Change.
Oh.
The idea being that what's about to happen, people look at it as a sort of a horrible end times kind of game where we're playing out all of these catastrophes simultaneously. But in actuality, what's about to happen could be very good. It could be something that's needed to happen for a very long time. And what happens on the far side of that could be better than what we have right now.
Wow, I'm glad you're optimistic about that. I'm a little frightened by it right now. Let's go to that. And I apologize. You're right. It's called The Great Change. The URL I have is peakserver.blogspot.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the idea is that we're at the peak of everything right now, peak of resources, peak of extraction, peak of wars, peak of, you know, you name it. And we're surfing through these times. So it's kind of like peak surfing the peak, right? We're at the top of the wave. And looking out ahead, what we see is nothing but down.
Well, I assume
a thrilling ride.
Yeah, I assume it also refers to peak oil.
It does.
Which we have we hit that point?
We hit it a few years back, and you know, we're into what they call unconventional liquids right now, which is a way of saying fracking with a euphemistic tone.
Mm-hmm.
But it essentially is prolonging this plateau, the peak of the wave. We're surfing along at the foamy top using unconventional techniques like fracking, but that's not going to last out this decade. We'll be seeing the end of that fairly soon.
And tar sands. Tar sands oil is also part of that.
Well, tar sands, and they're talking about the kerogens that might come out of early uncooked oil deposits and things like that. Well, all of those are much more expensive to produce, and in fact may not even be economical to produce. Shell Oil just canceled its entire $1 billion kerogen research program because they just decided this is never going to be economical to produce.
And at the same time this week, folks who've been paying attention to the news note that we have found that there are piles of pet coke in the Chicago area. First, they made noise and news in Detroit when they were blowing across the river and creating clouds of pet coke. Now it's in Chicago, thanks to the BP refinery mm-hmm. in Whiting, Indiana, which is upgrading and will be producing even more of that stuff. In some ways, Albert, you can see all this happening at once. It's almost like a train wreck in slow motion.
But my friend Colin Campbell compares it to going into the bar and it's closing hour and they've already had last rounds, so you can't get anything to drink, so you start cutting up the carpet and squeezing it into a glass to see if you get the last little bit.
I gotta say, that's not an experience I've had at Last Call.
Eat for yourself.
My question to you, Albert, is you've worked in what a lot of folks, and forgive me for saying this, would call alternative technologies. You live an alternative lifestyle. This is not the norm. What you do is not the norm for the United States of America and perhaps even the world. You might correct me on that one, but certainly this country. How do you get more people to understand the importance of your work and moving past this peak and to something, to a brighter future?
Well, it's a little tricky. For me, I had to go through quite a heavy cultural shift back in the early 70s when I left my promising legal career in New York City and joined a hippie commune in Tennessee and just, you know, embarrassed my parents terribly and looked like it was a lot of money down the drain. But, you know, I became an environmental attorney working out of the community, the farm in Tennessee. And for 20 years, I was fighting against bad guys, nuclear power plants and chemical industries. I actually got involved with this one chemical company that was fracking back in the early 1980s. They were injecting all of their toxins, so it was reverse fracking. Instead of getting things out of the ground, they were pumping things in, and they were putting all of the wastes from pesticides and herbicides into the ground. And in the process, I had to argue, you know, Tennessee may have a lot of surface water, but we need that water that's deep down there. We need to protect those aquifers. And so my principal arguments were the population is growing and climate is changing. So I had to go into court back in the 1980s and tell a Tennessee judge that climate was going to be a game changer. And I had to bring in experts. Al Gore was very helpful dredging the Congress and the agencies to give me lots of facts to use. And eventually I scared myself. I got totally frightened of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
And I got to the point where I put all that into a book. It was called Climate in Crisis. I wrote that around 1985. It got published finally in 1990. And from that, I left the practice of law because I had just been so shaken by this experience, worried about tipping points, worried about peak everything, worried about the direction that civilization was headed. And it's like we were like having a Thelma and Louise moment.
Yeah.
And once you're in midair, you don't really have a lot of options. So I had to, reassess my life, and I became a farmer. I became a mushroom grower. I actually ran a business selling shiitake spawn and things. But then as I got farther along, I started realizing, you know, actually communities can change and shift the way that they look at what's prosperity, redefine prosperity, redefine what's really good in your life. What makes your life good? And so this came around to the idea of eco-villages, and I started being involved with the Eco-Village Network of the Americas and then the Global Eco-Village Network. And lately I've kind of improved on that idea, which is to talk about cool villages or e-cool villages, villages that net sequester carbon while they're having a good time.
You know, one of the things that you mention and something that I've been interested in, I really haven't done a show on it yet, and it's about time, is biochar. In mm-hmm. fact, your last book was called The Biochar Solution, which came out in 2010. In 25 words or fewer, tell us about biochar.
I learned about this when I was going to a conference on permaculture in Brazil, and they had the dark earths of the Amazon, which is this kind of this mysterious fact of life down there, which is that you have tropical soils, and they for some reason there are patches in Brazil which are extremely fertile, which couldn't be explained for a very long time why they could have large civilizations in pre-Columbian times in such a tropically depleted area. I mean soil depletion. And then it turned out that those soils were man-made, and the secret factor, the key ingredient, was charcoal, that they had for thousands of years been putting charcoal into their soil. And, you know, I would distinguish what biochar is in to say that charcoal might come from a hardware store or a grocery store to put into your charcoal grill, but it probably has some petroleum additives so that it burns quickly. And instead, what you want is something that you want to put in your garden. So you want a clean charcoal, and that's what we call biochar. It's suitable for putting in your garden. And it makes the soil richer. It makes it more fertile. It makes it a home for all the microorganisms that help your plants grow.
And I've heard it talked about at a number of conferences here, horticultural conferences, as something that is the future, something we really need to be looking forward to and to utilizing. I've heard people talk about, for instance, like trees and tree pits in the city, put biochar around it and then they might actually have a chance.
Yeah, and it's really a paradigm shift in agriculture or horticulture, because you're not talking about chemistry here. We're not talking about adding nitrogen and phosphorus and so forth and making a plant grow. We're talking about adding biology. And what charcoal does is it provides a home for the bacteria and the fungi and the microarthropods that translate nutrients from minerals in the soil into something that the plant can eat. And the charcoal provides them a coral reef effect. It's air space, it's water, it's the ability to have a healthy biological community that really makes a plant grow.
I'm so glad to hear you talk about biology, because that's something that I do on this program. And as I say, it's the biology, stupid, because it's not just NPK, something that we've learned over the years, finally begun to understand that the biology in our soils is what is helping to keep our plants alive. And that's very, very important. I need to take a short break here, Albert, but we'll get back to Albert Bates. Who's director of the Global Village Institute for Appropriate Technology. He's resident of the farm in Summertown, Tennessee, and the keynote speaker at Great Lakes Bioneer Chicago on the 2nd of November. And I have all the information for that on my website, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show, and I hope you'll sign up for the conference. Albert, Lisa was looking at biochar, and she's fascinated by it. You know, during the break there, she was sort of hunting around on a search engine. And what would your question be, Lisa?
Well, so you may have said this. I was reading your blog. I'm reading and not listening to the radio show that I'm on. So then I ended up on Wikipedia looking at biochar. I'm not quite grasping. So how can I do this in my garden? And is it something that is, it seems as though it's something that is large scale that my farmer, my uncle who's a farmer, can do as well? Can you?
Yeah, you know, we found that there's really two styles of agriculture that were practiced in the world before the East and West came together at the time of Christopher Columbus. And on the one side of the world, the Western civilization began out of Egypt and the Mesopotamian Fertile Crescent, and then up into northern China and northern Africa and so on. And that style was based on irrigation in the plow, and it left the carbon out. It took the carbon and took it out of the soil. So it went from having 20% carbon in soils down to 5% or less today, and it left deserts everywhere that you had intensive population growth. Well, in the other side of the world, the Americas, they actually developed civilizations and they put more carbon into the soil. So the soils became richer and richer and richer and more fertile, even in tropics where they'd not had glaciation in millions of years. So how did that happen? Well, it's actually about the biology. And so if you just put charcoal into your garden, it's not going to help it very much. It's not going to grow very fast. In fact, it may look worse the first year. And the reason is because it actually needs to have those little microbes, that bacteria and fungal part of it. It needs to have compost. So that biology, which goes well with the charcoal, needs to be put in first. And so I always put my charcoal directly into my compost pile and turn it in the compost and then put that in the garden. And then I get dramatic improvements in my vegetables.
But where do people get this biochar? Is this becoming readily available now?
It's a chicken and an egg kind of problem because there are not a lot of manufacturers because there's not a lot of demand for it yet. And yet, you know, how are you going to get that demand if you don't have it available in the garden store? So there are a few brave entrepreneurs out there starting to produce it, and you're getting good compost mix, you know, with biochar mixed with worm castings. I highly recommend something like that. But the other way is just to start making it yourself. And in my book, The Biochar Solution, and in lots of different videos that are easily watched on YouTube, you can see people making charcoal in a variety of ways and then turning around and putting that into their garden or into their compost pile and then into their garden.
Well, we could go on for hours about this, and someday actually we should. But I want to give you a chance to preview your talk in the last couple of minutes here that we have, your talk called Cool Eco-Village Responses to Climate Change. What are you going to tell folks?
Well, a couple years back, the UN's Rapporteur on Human Rights started asking the hard question, what if food were a human right? What if we just had a treaty that was an international treaty and says everybody in the world has to eat? Can we actually allow that? Can we make that? Is that physically possible in this planet to do that? And his response was, yes, we can feed everyone. We can even feed a growing population, but we're going to have to change our methods of agriculture. We're going to have what he called eco-agriculture, but what he was really talking about was more of a permacultural, designed, organic, no-till, you know, all that kind of, all those tools, right? And my friend Darren Doherty calls it regrarianism. It's going back to things that we knew as traditional societies, coming along now with modern tools and spreading organic knowledge around the world. And actually, you produce more. You produce about a third more food that way than you do from conventional modern agrochemistry or whatever. And so these techniques now, we can begin to think about having integrated energy systems, renewable energy systems. We can think about having houses that are built so that they're climate adaptive and use very little embodied energy and provide you all of your basic needs right there in your surroundings. We can begin to integrate these kinds of things the way that some experimental villages have around the world, the eco-villages. There's about 20,000 eco-village experiments in the world right now.
Can I ask you a question? How many residents, citizens of those eco-villages, what's the typical size of an eco-village?
Well, the typical size is only a few hundred. There are millions of people living in them now. In fact, there's more than a million people living in eco-villages just in Sri Lanka. In Senegal, they now have a ministry of eco-villages in the government that hopes to have 18,000 eco-villages by the end of this decade.
Wow. And you have hope that this, well, you know, again, getting back to Blake, that's, when Blake Davis was on the show, he said, ultimately, folks are going to find out that it works better when you have a couple of hundred people all, you know, working for the same thing. But that doesn't seem realistic, given the population centers we have in the world today.
Yeah, you know, if you look at the major population centers, that they all have their individual challenges. A lot of them are going to be challenged by where they're located, which were created in times of a comfortable Holocene epoch when they were close to sea levels, well, those are now rising, or close to rivers that got their water from melting ice from the snow every year, and that's changing. So all of these cities are going to be stressed. They're going to have difficult times. I mean, look at the lake. Look at what the lake levels are and the toxicity of the lake and things like that. Mm-hmm. You wonder what's the future for Chicago in that department. Mm-hmm. So these are issues that are the major metropolitan areas are going to have. And if you look at the rural countryside, a lot of the problem that's been happening out there is sprawl, population growth, and also depletion of resources like soils, which are pretty critical to our future. So that's got to shift. All of those trends have to change. We have to have cities that are thinking green, that are becoming much more ecological in their outlook and planning, and we have to have rural areas that are putting fertility back into the landscape and creating more fertile examples. And I think that's actually what the strategy here is to find ways to make demonstrations, to make examples that others can emulate. I think people learn that way much more from the carrot than from the stick. They see something they like and they emulate it.
You know, again, and here's an example of what you're talking about. You're talking about urban sprawl and every day there's an example of the kinds of things you're talking about. I mentioned earlier the petcoke piles along the Calumet River, and we're going to talk next week to Tom Shepard from the Southeast Environmental Task Force about that, by the way.
Okay.
But this week, the Ileana Tollway received approval from the Metropolitan Planning Organization Policy Committee, which is a great disappointment because it's going to contribute to the urban sprawl if they can find the money for it. And, it's going to be put on the backs of the taxpayers. You know that's going to happen. But it was something that folks have been fighting because they know the damage that just extending outward and outward and outward can do instead of coming back into the city and using the resources we have here. So, again, there's another example for you, Albert, when you do your talk about what's going on right here in this area that people can relate to.
Right, and I've run into this problem of language. We tend to villainize different kinds of toxic producers and so forth, and we tend to talk about climate change in terms like carbon negative or carbon minus or emissions reductions. And Bill Clinton used to say, nobody gets elected by promising people less. And so by focusing on the negative, we tend to not get buy-in or early adoption of some of these things that are actually pretty good for us and help us out in a variety of ways. That's the whole nature of my language choice in when I start talking about cool and cool villages and cool cities and cool fuels and cool gardening. Is I'm trying to get something going here that's a more viral meme. It's mm-hmm. something, Japanese schoolgirls would like.
Well, I got one for you. Biochar in every pot.
Yeah.
There we go. All right. That is Albert Bates. And if you want more information about him, his books, about his talk coming up at Great Lakes Bioneer Chicago, go to my website, MikeNovak.net. The conference is the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at Roosevelt University, 430 South Michigan Avenue. You can sign up now. Go online right now and sign up. And I'm looking forward to meeting you, Albert.
I am too, Mike. I hope to see you there.
All right. Oh, you will. All right. Take care. Have a great Sunday.
Bye now.